The Jodcast with Roy Smits, Tim O'Brien, Ian Morrison, and Nick Rattenbury. The Jodcast, October Extra Edition. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. Now, as you have noticed, there is no Dave with us this issue because he is currently in India. Also, Stuart is in Trieste. Roy is in Australia. So joining me this issue is Ian Morrison. Hi, Ian.
Hello to you, Nick.
And now, so thank you very much to everybody who has been downloading the Jodcast and listening to us and sending us your feedback.
And thanks to Joe Jones, and there's Daniel Scott Jordan. And of course, any comments, feedback, questions, just go to www.jodcast.net. Well, as a Jodrell Bank, they've been having some fun building up some relatively simple kit to observe meteor trails. How does it work? Well, essentially, we have an aerial on the roof of our control building that's picking up, sometimes, signals from a television transmitter in Spain. Now, normally, of course, signals from a transmitter in Spain wouldn't be received in the UK. But if a meteor comes roughly halfway between us, high in the sky, then it causes a trail of ionization. The energy from a little dust particle that comes into the atmosphere splits electrons off the atoms, and then you get what are called ions. You get a plasma, which is why we can see at night it's quite hot. But those free electrons, when the signal from the radio TV transmitter reaches them, vibrate in sympathy and reflect those signals forwards, so our receiver at Jodrell Bank can pick them up. So we get a little ping each time a meteor comes into the atmosphere, roughly halfway between Jodrell and Spain. Now, in fact, Roy Smits is going to interview Eddie Blackhurst, who was the technician at Jodrell Bank, who actually put the equipment together. And he and Megan Argo, I'm sure you remember Megan, they basically got the whole system going to very great effect.
I'm standing outside of Jodrell Bank, where there's an antenna attached to the roof. And it doesn't look like it, but apparently this is a meteor detector. So I'll go inside and talk to Eddie Blackhurst, who is a receiver technician, and he might be able to explain to me how this works. It really just looks like a normal antenna. Hello, Eddie. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Hi, Roy. Yeah, no problem.
I was just outside looking at the meteor detector. Can you maybe explain how this works?
Yeah, sure. It's a very, very simple system. What we're looking for is reflections off meteors from distant transmitters which are located over the horizon. So we can't pick them up by normal means. They have to be reflected off the meteors. And the system comprises of a very simple dipole tuned to the frequency of the transmitter. The transmitter being located somewhere in Europe for our application. We then have a simple filter arrangement, an amplifier, and then just use an ordinary scanning receiver which is capable of receiving single sideband signals. And then when we have a meteor ionized, we hear a tone in the audio from the receiver effectively, and that tone is then fed into a piece of software which then analyzes the change in pitch effectively, and it's that you see displayed on the Jodrell website.
So you mentioned the emitter is somewhere in Europe, but what kind of emitter is that?
We believe it's actually a TV transmitter, one of the old low-frequency transmitters of the type that we used to have many years ago in the UK, running at 48 and a quarter megahertz.
So there's a television antenna broadcasting somewhere in Europe, and you're picking up the reflections of that antenna due to the tail of the meteorites.
Yes, effectively. I mean, obviously we can't see the transmitter line of sight because the horizon's in the way. But the waste energy, if you like, from the transmitter, obviously some of it goes out towards space and into space. But when the meteors ionize, the plasma generated in the form of the tail reflect the radio waves, and we can actually detect them.
Can we have a look at the website?
Yeah, sure. So here we go. Here we have the website now.
So what we see here is a big graph, two-dimensional graph, and on the x-axis is the last 5 minutes, that's time. On the y-axis is frequency, and the colors, they represent meteors?
Yes, you can see that predominantly most of the page just has random noise, which is shown up in light blue. Where we get a meteor burning up and the tone that we detect, you can actually see that represented by a white dot or a line as the tail disperses and stops reflecting.
So on the Jodrell Bank website, people can see live meteors.
Live meteors, yes.
That is fantastic. We'll most certainly put a link on the Jodcast website directly to your meteor detector. So can you explain me what exactly is a meteor?
A meteor generally is just a grain of dust, effectively, which gets dragged into the Earth's atmosphere by gravity. It enters at extremely high velocity and burns up in the upper atmosphere.
Do these meteors sometimes hit the Earth?
Occasionally. Most of the meteorites that actually land, if you like, end up in the oceans, unfortunately, for us meteor fans. Generally, the ones that do fall are pretty small, though, and I really must indicate to people that they really shouldn't be worried about big meteor impacts.
So how did you come up with the idea of building a meteor detector?
Well, it all really stems to one of my old colleagues, Megan Argo, who...
That's our Megan Argo from the Jodcast.
Our Megan Argo, the legendary Megan Argo from the Jodcast. Megan wanted to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Lovell telescope last year by setting up a meteor detector. Some of the early experiments that Sir Bernard Lovell did when he came to this site at Jodrell Bank after the war in the late 1940s were research into meteors, effectively, using radar techniques. And we thought it was a good idea, perhaps, to set a system up to commemorate this. I did the radio side of the experiment, and Megan did the computing side, and we set a nice little system up, as can be seen.
So I see you brought a few meteors.
Yes, we have a few examples here in front of us, Roy, which I've collected over the years. I've got two very nice examples of a meteor which fell many, many years ago. I think it was prehistoric times, perhaps, called the Gibeon meteorite, which landed in Namibia in South Africa. It's a nickel-iron meteorite, extremely heavy for their size, as you might imagine, with a black fusion crust, which is quite typical of nickel-iron meteorites.
So when a meteor lands on the Earth and it leaves a little residue, that is called a meteorite?
Yes, that's correct. Only the cinder, if you like, that lands on Earth is the meteorite. Otherwise, it's just a meteor, and that's what you see.
So these objects have actually travelled probably many, many millions of kilometres through space before they hit the Earth.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these probably were formed from the cores of stars as well, so they've been around for a considerably long time. They are absolutely incredible when you look at them.
So why do you collect these? What fascinates you about them?
I think it all stems from being a young child years ago, asking my parents about, always reading books on astronomy and asking my parents about meteors and meteorites and being fascinated by them. And I'll never forget the buzz of actually seeing my very first meteor, and that I was just bitten by the bug there and then, really.
So this meteor detector, does it also have any scientific value?
Yes, very, very possibly. One thing that we are doing with it, and there is actually a link off the meteor webpage, if you look along the tabs on the left-hand side of the page, we're actually involved in counting meteors. And our data is actually displayed on this website. If you look at the tab, it's called Meteor Observatories Around the World. And a collection of amateurs are uploading the data to this website, the counting data, and that could be used for statistical purposes.
Would it be helpful to have more of these antennas?
Absolutely. I mean, this would be a really good project for schools and private individuals to take up. And indeed, perhaps we will consider putting some instructions on the website at some point on how to set the system up.
So schools could go to the website and find out how to build their own meteor detector?
Yes, I think eventually we'll put the information on and let people have a go. And perhaps we can get, you know, people as enthused as I am about meteors.
So I understand you also have recording of some audio of this meteor detector. Can we listen to that?
We do, Roy. And here we have a recording taken several years ago for the Leonid meteor storm that we had. Here you will hear a tone, which is actually one of the meteors ionising. So if you have a listen to this.
That was a big one.
Yeah, it was a reasonable size one.
Okay, so not only can we see meteors, we can even hear them. That's beautiful.
Yeah, you can hear them too. And that the tone's generated by the receiver, but it's due to the carrier being picked up, reflected off the meteor effectively. Mm-hmm. It's that tone that we've just heard that the software we're using generates or utilises.
What is your software based on? What software do you use for the meteor detector?
Okay, the software is actually freely available to download from the internet. It's an audio spectrum analyzer package written for amateur radio applications, and it's called Spectrum Lab.
So would you mind if people contacted you if they're interested in this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that would be fine, Roy. It'd be good to gauge the amount of interest that people have in setting a system up like this for themselves. And perhaps if the interest's sufficient, then, you know, we can help people get involved in doing it for themselves.
We'll put your contact details on the website of the Jodcast.
Okay, yeah, sure. That'll be fine.
Thank you very much for talking to us.
My pleasure, Roy. It's been lovely. Thank you.
Thanks, Roy. Now, we've had a number of questions sent in from various listeners over the last couple of weeks. So without any further ado, here is Dr. Tim O'Brien answering your questions with Ask an Astronomer. Thank you very much again for coming along and answering people's questions.
No problem.
First question is from Stephen Harper, and he writes, getting started with astronomy, help required. He finds it's an excellent show, fascinating and really informative. Thank you very much for that. Now, he's just bought a telescope and he's started learning to enjoy the night sky with his two children. They are fascinated by the moon. How and what should I go on to show them next? Any advice gratefully received?
Well, this is a great question, of course, and the moon is superb through a telescope. And in fact, I've often talked to people about what are the best things to look at through a telescope when you first get one. And certainly looking at the moon is a thing to do. It feels like you're flying above the surface of the moon. You sort of scan across you're flying above the craters. You can see incredible details of the mountains and the craters and so on. And actually one of the, good things if you're looking at the moon is to choose a time when the phase of the moon is such that it's not like a completely full moon. You might think that full moon would be when the surface pointing towards us is fully lit would be the best time to look at it. But in fact, you're better off looking at one of the phases where maybe you've got a sort of half moon or something. And then to look down what we call the terminator, which is the point which is where the moon goes from being lit to being in shadow. It's that sort of boundary line between the dark part of the moon and the lit part of the moon. Because you see shadows, the light's sort of coming from the side, and you get a really good 3D effect. When it's illuminated from the front, and so the whole surface of the moon is lit, the full moon, then you lose a lot of the depth information that you otherwise get. So certainly next time, make sure you do look at the moon when you in that sort of phase, sort of half moon, you know, or a waxing or waning phase. In terms of what to go on and show them next, then I would say that with a telescope or binoculars, Jupiter is the classic. Look at the planet Jupiter, find the planet Jupiter, download one of these packages that we've talked about a number of times before, like Stellarium or CarduCL or something that will tell you where and when to look for Jupiter. But looking at Jupiter through a small telescope or even a pair of binoculars, you should be able to see first of all, the moons of Jupiter. So four of the biggest moons of Jupiter, the so-called Galilean satellites. So these will look like points of light, like stars, effectively, on sort of usually spread in a sort of line, more or less, horizontally across an angle across Jupiter. Maybe one on one side, three on the other. Maybe two on one side, two on the other. Maybe one of them will be missing because it's either behind or in front of Jupiter, and you won't notice it. They're called the Galilean satellites because Galileo saw them. And interestingly enough, it's the International Year of Astronomy next year. It's 400 years since Galileo first pointed a telescope at Jupiter and saw those moons. So if nothing else, during the year 2009, look at Jupiter's moons and think of Galileo. The other thing, on Jupiter itself, look for the cloud bands. You should be able to see through a telescope. You should be able to see these bands of different colours running across. Through a small telescope, they probably look sort of darker brown, lighter brown, whitish coloured. These are these cloud bands that you see in the gorgeous sort of Hubble Space Telescope pictures of Jupiter. You can see them through a small telescope. Lovely to be able to see that. Even the Great Red Spot can be seen. This is this big rotating storm in the atmosphere of Jupiter. That can be seen through a small telescope. Saturn's rings. Again, an amazing sight. You know, I've shown many people Saturn through a small telescope, and they're always completely gobsmacked, if you understand that turn of phrase, when they look at Saturn, and you can see that it really does have rings. It really does have these little ears that sit out, sticking out either side of it. I would say that there's other things that you should look at in the sky that you maybe don't need a telescope for, actually. So you have a checklist of what to see. We've had the moon, we've had Jupiter and its moons, we've had Saturn and its rings. I would say get somewhere dark, dark sky, away from street lights. Look for the Milky Way. So try and see the Milky Way sort of arching across the sky. A gorgeous, gorgeous sight. If you're in the Southern Hemisphere, then obviously the Magellanic Clouds are another amazing thing. These nearby dwarf irregular galaxies close to our own Milky Way galaxy. Meteor showers, shooting stars. Everyone should try and spot a shooting star. If you go and look at a time of year when there's actually a meteor shower going on, then you've got a better chance of seeing a shooting star. That's basically when the Earth passes through the tail of a comet, or what's left over from the tail of a comet, big lump of dust orbiting the sun. And as the Earth passes through, we get many little bits of dust that burn up in the atmosphere and cause these shooting stars to whiz across. So look out for a shooting star, but you will see them, you know, any clear night. If you spend a bit of time outside looking up at the sky, you'll probably spot the occasional one, even if it's not a meteor shower, period. And then finally, the Andromeda Galaxy, I would say. You can see it through a telescope. It's much easier to find through a telescope, but in fact, probably the exciting thing to try to do is to spot it with the unaided eye, without a telescope or binoculars. And that's simply a matter of, you need to get a star map. You need to get a star map, like from Stellarium or something. Find where it is. Usually the trick is to work from the square of Pegasus and out through the constellation of Andromeda, sort of turn right and there you've got Andromeda. So you need to sort of star hop, jump from one star to the next to find the Andromeda Galaxy. You can see it with the unaided eye. It's not spectacular. It's a very faint, little hazy patch of light. You have to know exactly where to look. You often have to, it has to be a very dark sky. You have to, sometimes use a little bit of what we call averted vision, which is you look just to the side of the galaxy, and that opens up, starts to use a bit of the eye that's a bit more sensitive to very faint light. But you can see that little fuzzy patch. And the amazing thing about seeing that is that you know you're seeing a different galaxy. That's actually the farthest you can see with your unaided eye, generally. It's about 2 million light years away. So not only are you looking 2 million light years out into space, you're looking 2 million years into the past. So it's just, you know, it's an amazing thing to think about doing, and I would encourage you to do that. So, get out there with your kids and show them these things. I'm sure they'll be amazed by it all. I should just say that I apologise for my rather croaky voice at the moment. I'm talking about having kids and so on. I suspect I've picked something up from my daughter, who's gone back to school recently and met all the other kids who've obviously carrying all these bugs, or it's possibly our undergraduate students, since they've all recently arrived back at university. So I'm a bit ropey at the moment. Sorry.
So thank you, Stephen, for your question. Next question is from Daniel, and still with the moon. He says that he just got his first views of the moon, and he was so surprised. He thanks us, too, for the monthly night sky segment of the Jodcast, and he just noted that when he was looking at the moon, he found himself partially blinded due to the radiance of the moon. So he was curious to know if there is a safe time or way to view the moon through a telescope or any other kind of optics, presumably, so that you don't get dazzled.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's right, actually. The moon is spectacularly bright through a telescope. And, of course, you know, when you think about it, that's the point of a telescope. Most telescopes have got a bigger aperture. So the you would look at the diameter of this sort of end of the telescope, if you like. So it's the diameter of the lens or the mirror that your telescope uses. And that's can be quite large. I mean, some of the larger sort of small telescopes are something like maybe 25 centimeters in diameter. Is quite a large telescope that you might have at home. Well, if you compare that to your eye, even when it's dilated, when the pupil is dilated at its largest, it's probably, what, 5 millimeters across or something, maybe a little bigger. You know, that's 5 millimeters compared to 25 centimeters. That's a factor 50. So in terms of area, which matters, because that's what the light's being collected over, that's the square of 50. So that's what, 2,500. Mm. So you're actually getting 2,500 times more light in than you would in through your pupil. So it certainly appears very bright. I mean, you're not going to be blinded by it unless you're, you know, the sort of size of telescopes we're talking about here. But it's certainly an issue. You would, you know, your eyes, if you're out at night, your eyes have got used to the dark, then your pupils opened right up. Even as you approach an eyepiece, actually, I would carefully approach an eyepiece that was the weather telescope that was looking at the moon. You'll see the brightness sort of radiating out of it. And actually what that'll do is it'll close down your pupil. And actually you'll find that a bit easier to look at the moon then. An alternative is, if you don't want to ruin your dark adaptation, is you can get little moon filters that sort of screw into the eyepiece of your telescope.
Are they just neutral density filters?
Yeah, so they just block the light right across the spectrum, so they're just sort of chopping out some proportion of the light, and just to make the moon look fainter. And it means that you can sort of look at the moon, and then you can still look back up at the sky and see the stars. Otherwise, if you look at the moon through a telescope, you look back up, everything's black and like Daniel says, you know, you can even get the sort of, you know, patches, you know, the sort of after images on your eye from looking at something bright. So yeah, it's not something to particularly worry about. I would say, again, just a little pointer. Of course, if you were looking at the moon around the time of a solar eclipse, then it would be a problem, right?
Yes. because
of course the sun is very close by in the sky. Just don't look at the moon when it's that close to the sun. It's not a good idea. Never ever go anywhere near the sun with a telescope or binoculars, or indeed your unaided eye.
Very good. Thank you for that. Now to another Daniel Scott Jordan. And he writes, he would like to know the names of any simple reference books that will help him recognize constellations. And he also asks if there are any special filters that you can get that will cut out the light pollution when observing from within a city.
Okay, yeah, well, I'll tell you what we do. I think the easiest thing to do is to just put a few examples. There are, you know, there's lots, of course. There's lots of books that will at various different levels will give you an idea of what you can look out for in the sky. So I think there's some that are updated every year. There's some that, you know, are good reference books that are always, you know, long-standing things. I think best thing for us to do is to put a few suggested ones on our webpage. That sound like a good idea.
We've been meaning to do this for some time, actually, is to put a list of books that we use for just basic night sky observing. And the one which I used to learn the night sky was Will Tyrion and Ian Ridpath, Stars and Planets. It's an excellent book. The maps were easy to read, and there's lots of useful information in there as well. So that's just one. As you mentioned, there's lots of others. So we'll put a list of those on our website.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that they're the only ones we'd recommend either, because of course there are many more. But we'll just stick a few on there just for pointers. Regarding this business about filters, he's actually talking about. This is a problem that you know, if particularly to do with light pollution, where, you know, if you live in a city or in a town and, you know, the sky can be quite bright as a result of the street lights. And is there any way of blocking that? Well, there is, as you might imagine. There are filters that don't do a perfect job. And in fact, it would be far better if the lights just weren't there, of course. But there are filters that you can get that sort of screw into the eyepiece, for example, of your telescope, and they would try and block patches of the spectrum, bits of the spectrum where those streetlights are likely to produce much of the pollution. For example, some of the older style streetlights use sodium lamps. So there's a sort of gaseous sodium inside the street lamps, and they radiate very specific bits of the spectrum largely. And so one could design a filter that just blocks that bit of the spectrum and does a bit of a better job of making this background sky a bit darker. They do, you know, they can be pricey, however. So again, we might just stick some information on about that, along with the moon filter we just mentioned as well.
And our final question for this edition of Ask an Astronomer comes from Frank Sørensen, and he notes that the hype surrounding the LHC accidentally annihilating the world by creating a microscopic black hole seems to have evaporated, since we're all still here, presumably. However, he has been thinking about an argument regarding what would happen if you did have a very small black hole, which could pass through the entire planet without swallowing anything more than a few atomic nuclei, since the vast constituent of ordinary matter is actually empty space. And so Frank wonders what would happen if a cosmic ray particle collided with the upper layer of a neutron star and created a small black hole. On a neutron star, there's no empty space for the black hole to hide in, since it is one big atomic nucleus. So the question is, why doesn't microscopic black holes created by cosmic rays swallow the neutron stars?
Okay, well, complicated question. But in fact, you know, it's got, well, there's a couple of interesting things to pick up. I mean, this thing, the LHC is the Large Hadron Collider, that we talked about, I think, possibly in the last edition of the Ask an Astronomer section. This is the big particle collider that, that was switched on recently at CERN in Europe. There was this fear that it was going to create black holes that might swallow up the Earth. It was a bit of a scare story, as we actually discussed last time. And of course, you know, as Frank points out, we are still all here, presumably anyway. And so it didn't happen. Of course, one of the interesting things is it didn't happen because, apart from anything else, they didn't actually collide any beams together when they were switching it on, so it was never going to happen until they do that. And now the LHC is a bit broken as well, so it's not going to, there's going to be a bit of a delay in all this again. However, the basic answer to this whole question, you can pick up on some real details if you want them by looking at a big safety report that was written by a number of scientists from CERN and elsewhere, looking at the safety of the collisions that are happening in the Large Hadron Collider to sort of try and answer these sorts of questions. And I think maybe, this whole issue about whether a black hole would be produced and why aren't neutron stars, swallowed up by these black holes then, since cosmic rays will be crashing into neutron stars all the time, presumably producing these black holes, and therefore, you know, why aren't they swallowed up? Well, here's quoting from the LHC safety report. One might wonder what would happen if a stable microscopic black hole could be produced at the LHC. However, we reiterate that this would require a violation of some of the basic principles of quantum mechanics, a cornerstone of the laws of nature, in order for the black hole decay rate to be much less than the production rate, or indeed general relativity, in order to suppress Hawking radiation, which would cause the black holes to evaporate. So basically what they're saying is, if one could speculate that maybe it produces microscopic black holes, however, that would require a breakdown of all the laws of physics that we think we understand at the moment. So we actually don't think they will produce black holes. But let's say they might. There's lots of other information in the safety report about various issues, but let me just pick up on the issue that Frank refers to, which is the issue of the black holes that might therefore be being produced when cosmic rays hit dense stars. So it says, in fact, ultra-high energy cosmic rays hitting dense stars, such as white dwarfs and neutron stars, would have produced black holes copiously during their lifetimes. I'll add the comment, if indeed black holes were being produced, and, you know, we didn't understand physics as we think we do. Such black holes would have been stopped by the material inside such dense stars, which is what Frank is saying. The stars are so dense that these black holes, if they're produced as the cosmic rays crashing, get trapped inside the star. Because again, quoting from the LHC report, the rapid accretion due to the large density of these bodies and to the strong gravitational interactions of these black holes would have led to the destruction of the white dwarfs and neutron stars on timescales that are much shorter than their observed lifetimes. The final stages of their destruction would have released explosively large amounts of energy that would have been highly visible. The observation of white dwarfs and neutron stars that would have been destroyed in this way tells us that cosmic rays do not produce such black holes, and hence neither will the LHC. So in fact, the answer to, you know, Frank's point was, why don't microscopic black holes created by cosmic rays swallow the neutron stars? Well, if microscopic black holes were created by cosmic rays, they would have swallowed the neutron stars, and since they haven't, they're not being produced, which is actually what our normal laws of physics tell us would be the case, that we shouldn't be producing those things.
So it was a very satisfying answer to an excellent question.
Okay.
Thank you very much indeed, Tim. And if you've got any questions that you'd like Tim to answer, please do write to us at the Jodcast. via the webpage. And until next time, thank you very much. So there you go. Lots of excellent questions coming in from you folk out there. If you do have any questions at all about astronomy, the latest research, what you can see in the night sky, anything at all, do please ask us those questions. Just go to www.jodcast.net and click on the Ask an Astronomer link and send us your questions.
Many of you will know or have heard of what was called the COBE spacecraft that mapped the radiation left over from the Big Bang. In fact, the observations are of what the universe was like just under 400,000 years after its origin. And the universe wasn't smooth then, it was lumpy. And the lumpiness basically gave rise to the galaxies like our own Milky Way where we live. A new spacecraft called Planck is to be launched early next year to do what COBE did, but hopefully even better, to extend the range of detail that can be seen. And this is telling us a lot about the very earliest, 10th to minus 35th of a second after the origin, a time when there was a period called the inflationary period. So we hope we'll learn an awful lot about the Big Bang and what happened afterwards. The receivers, or many of the receivers, for this spacecraft have actually been built at the Jodrell Bank Observatory, and they are some of the very, very best in the world at the range of frequencies they're going to observe at. So to learn more, Nick is going to interview Roberta Palladini.
So my name is Roberta Palladini. I work at IPAC, which is so the Infrared Processing Astronomy Center. IPAC is part of Caltech, and in particular I work for the Spitzer Science Center. So Spitzer is it's an infrared satellite. It's one of the three big satellites launched by NASA. The other two are Hubble and GLAST.
Mm-hmm. You specifically work in infrared observations.
Yeah, I work within Spitzer. I work for MIPS, the MIPS instrument team. MIPS is one of the three instruments on board Spitzer. Mm-hmm. The other two are IRAC and IRS. MIPS covers the wavelengths between 24, 70, 160 micron.
Okay.
And in particular, within the team, I work for the 70 micron and the characterization of the array at 70 micron.
It's fun to think that these telescopes have got separate teams working on separate parts of the wavelength spectrum.
Yeah.
Why is that? I mean, it's just a different number, isn't it? Surely, why do you have to have a whole separate team working on a different wavelength band?
Well, we have different teams because, first of all, the different wavelengths are covered by, so the three instruments are very different from the technological point of view. So you really need a different expertise. So this is why we have different teams, because one person can be specialized in germanium, like I am, and somebody else can be specialized in a silicon array.
So this is what the CCD cameras are made of?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So it's down to the instrumentation and the material science, basically, that you're expert in?
You basically need a little bit of background in this respect. Mm. And so what we do within the team is really we try to, let's say, study all the properties of the array. Now that Spitzer has been in flight for 5 years, so we have lots of data that we can use for characterizing the behavior. We can also use all the data which were taken in the lab before the launch. So we, of course, also use those data. But in flight, so in space, things usually are different than in the lab. And so this is why we need to do this work of characterization.
How close can you get to in situ experiments in the lab? How close can you get to the telescope being in space, working in the lab?
Well, you get, in a way, quite close to the behavior. But then there are always surprises. So in a way, you roughly know before the launch, for example, how the sensitivity is going to be of the array, how the angular resolution is going to be. But then, for example, again, for the MIPS array, once the satellite was launched, it was found out that half of the array was dead.
Half of the array was dead?
Half of it. is dead, and it's permanently dead. And of course, it couldn't be repaired because it was already space. Mm. So you had to live with it. And the data actually of the other half of the array are very good. But that means basically you have to characterize something that is completely unexpected. So you have to try to understand, for example, what the impact of the dead part on the part which is actually working is. That's one of the problems. Mm. And also in terms of coverage, that means a very big problem because you expect you to cover the sky with a full array and you end up having a half of the array. So there are lots of problems like this on along the way.
How can half a dead CCD array affect the good half, the living half?
Well, one of the problem that was basically at the very beginning in 2003 when Spitzer was launched, and basically after a few months, even before that, the engineers realized that basically half of it was dead. And the problem was a an electronic connection, basically, of that part of the array with the rest of the spacecraft. So at the beginning, since it was not clear exactly which cables were involved in this process, we really needed to know, well, exactly what part of the array was dead and what part was working. Then once we realized that it was just a cable, and I say just, because fortunately that means the other part of the array is fine. Mm. But basically at that stage, it was clear that the part which is alive, let's say, is not affected really by the other part. But at the beginning, it was not clear if it was something more severe. So you can have some problems of like crosstalks, let's say, right, things like that.
Why could you not send astronauts to Spitzer to fix Spitzer in the same way that we could fix Hubble?
That's a good question. I think that, well, that's very expensive. That's basically probably the answer. And NASA, especially these days, is very careful about expenses. So whenever you can avoid doing something like that, you avoid doing it. And since, for example, it was clear that we could live with half of the array, so that the mission is not lost, also because we have other two instruments, IRAC and IRS. So it was basically clear since the beginning that the problem could be solved from the ground, just basically characterizing the array. And so that avoids sending basically a space shuttle in space with astronauts, with all the costs related to the space
shuttle. Are you mainly an instrument scientist?
No.
What else do you do?
Actually, my background is completely different. So before I arrived in Spitzer, I was working for Planck. So I'm a Planck scientist. I'm still involved with Planck. And I was basically my work within Planck has always been the characterization of the foregrounds.
Remind us a little bit about Planck first before you go on.
Okay, so Planck is mainly ESA, so the European Space Agency project, but has also very big involvement from NASA. It's a satellite which is going to be launched next year from the French Guiana, from Kiruna. It's going to be launched by Ariane. Mm-hmm. And the goal of this satellite is to study the cosmic microwave background, which is the relic of the Big Bang, let's say, and in particular the temperature and polarization and anisotropies of the CMB. So that's the main goal of Planck.
It's essentially the successor to WMAP.
Yes.
And WMAP was a successor to COBE. So
exactly.
it's the next in a line of satellites studying the cosmic microwave
Absolutely.
Background.
Absolutely.
How much better is Planck going to be over WMAP?
The jump is going to be very big with Planck because we are going to have, for example, a frequency coverage much bigger. So WMAP was covering just the relatively low radio frequencies, so from 20 to 90 gigahertz. While with Planck, we are going to go all the way to 857 gigahertz. So it's a very big jump in frequency coverage. And having lots of frequency channels means that also you can keep track of the foreground much better, which means basically that you can remove all the contaminants with respect to the CMB much better than what WMAP did.
This is a big problem, isn't it? Because you mentioned before about your work in Spitzer, understanding the systematics of the instrumentation, working out exactly how it's performing in these in the telescope in orbit. You have to make sure that what you're measuring when the numbers come off the telescope, your images, you're actually measuring something real rather than just an instrument behaving slightly oddly. Yeah. In this case, it's a little bit different. When you talk about foregrounds, you're talking about some real physical phenomenon in between us and the cosmic microwave background, which is this, they call it the surface of last scattering back after the Big Bang. You're talking about something real out there, something which is causing a foreground signal. Explain a little bit of what you mean by a foreground signal.
So a foreground signal is a signal which is emitted, as you were saying, from a real physical emitter, in this case, which can be our galaxy or external galaxies. And this emitter is, this emission, I should say, is overlapped to the emission that we want to study. So it's, for the cosmology, foregrounds are something like an emission that they want to get rid of. So they want to remove this emission, which is, again, overlapped on a signal, which is a very tiny little signal, which is the emission produced by the cosmic microwave background, which is at the level of the noise, actually, of the instrument. So basically, we need to dig into the data to find the kind of holy grail of cosmology, which is CMB, the temperature and isotropies, and even more polarization, which is an even smaller signal. And to do that, we need to remove all this emission, which is produced by our galaxy and by external galaxies. And in order to do that, we need a lot of modeling, which is the preparatory work that we do before a mission like Planck. And then basically a mission like Planck has been optimized in order to have all these big frequency coverages for coverage again to remove, this emission as much as we can.
So you start off with a model of our galaxy in this case. What are you modeling? Are you modeling the gas, the stars, the dark matter? What exactly are you putting into your galactic model?
Basically, we try to model everything at the same time. And that's the tough goal. Because our knowledge, and that in a way this is very surprising, that our knowledge of our galaxy in this frequency range is still quite poor. And that's the surprise in a way, because we, as cosmologists, we can predict the emission from the CMB, with very big accuracy. But at the same time, we cannot predict with the same accuracy the emission from our own galaxy. So that's the tough, challenge in a way, because of this emission, from 23 gigahertz all the way to 857. Gigahertz, which is the emission covered by the bands of Planck, is a mixture of many different physical mechanisms. So we have a synchrotron radiation, which is produced, for example, by the cosmic rays accelerated by the magnetic field of our galaxy. We have the free-free emission, which is produced by the ionized gas of our galaxy. And then we have dust emission, which is produced by the dust in our galaxy. And then we have this called anomalous emission. And we call it anomalous because we don't even know what it is.
Oh, very good.
So it's also called the X emission. And nowadays we know for sure that we have a fourth component, but we don't know what is responsible basically for this emission. We think it is like grains of dust, very small grains of dust. But we are not sure.
Is it important to know what it is? I mean, this anomalous emission, or can you just say it's there and we can subtract it? Is that enough?
Yes and no. Because yes and no. Because in a way, for example, in an experiment like Planck, we have set up a group of people, which is very big, and these people apply what are called component separation methods. So they take the data produced by emission like Planck, And they apply these methods, which are supposed to be blind, so they don't make assumptions on the components of emissions, for example, the foregrounds and the CMB, and they just try to disentangle the components which are in the data. So they basically say, okay, I have a map A, and I know that this map A is made of a component B, C, D, and E. I don't know what these components are, and I just try to separate them out. Or there are component separation methods which make some little assumptions, because we know that to, let's say, to avoid making assumptions and to work in a completely blind way for these methods is very complicated. So this is a way to go. The problem is that when you end up with these maps and you don't know what the physical mechanisms are, you don't know if what you have subtracted, let's say what you have separated out and distinguished from the CMB, is really physical or not. Mm. It could be something spurious. And if you don't know, if you don't have any physical ground, you can really end up with something totally fake. Or it could be noise, and you basically have no idea. So this is why you really need some knowledge. And this is what we are doing a little bit at the moment.
One question which might be a bit naive, although we are, the sun is going around the center of the galaxy in the plane of the galaxy, in the disk of the galaxy. So we are part of the galactic disk. Are there directions which we can point Planck which are going to be less affected by the galaxy than others?
So that's a very good question. So with Planck, like WMAP or COBE, these are full sky experiments. So they cover the entire sky, including the galaxy. After acquiring the data, what we are going to do to really study the CMB, so the cosmic microwave background, is in general, we mask the galaxy. That's the first thing we do.
Just blank it out.
Yeah. Because at the end, recovering the CMB is a statistical, statistical signal. So you just want to make sure that you don't mask a too big region in the sky. Otherwise, you end up with too little statistics, and that's a problem for what we call map making methods. And map making are these methods which recover a map of the CMB, and also after that to recover the cosmological parameters. That this is what we want. So we need to make sure that we don't mask too much. But that's usually the first approach. You don't look for the CMB in the plane of the galaxy, because that would be a lost battle, basically, because the foregrounds are going to win.
Yes.
We don't know the foregrounds at the level of subtracting them out so well that we managed to recover the CMB in the galaxy. So we are obliged to do this. So once again, unfortunately, we do need to know some of the physics of these foregrounds. And we are not at the stage yet. We are not good enough to do that. So that's one step, blanking the galaxy. But at the same time, these experiments have as a goal also to recover maps of the foregrounds. Because in fact, at the same time, we also want to improve our knowledge of these foregrounds for the future experiments.
You just don't want to say, oh, it's just an annoying signal, let's get rid of it and get to the good bit,
exactly,
which is a CMB.
Exactly.
It's interesting in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, because cosmologists, in these big experiments, there are cosmologists and people who are interested, actually, in these emissions, like myself. I belong to the second category. So it's a complex game in which some people see these emissions like trash, in a way. Mm-hmm. They want to get rid of it. But the other people, they say, no, this is important. And again, it is important also for cosmology, because the better we know these foregrounds, the better we will be able to recover the CMB in the future, the polarization.
Now, Planck isn't flying at the moment, so you're obviously not getting the data from Planck to model the foregrounds. Where are you getting the information from to model the foreground signal?
So we basically get the information from all the previous experiments, including WMAP. And COBE, but WMAP in this respect is basically the best source of information, but also from lots of other ancillary data. So, for example, for the synchrotron M33, there are experiments observations, which are done specifically aiming at the observation of the synchrotron and the free frame. So, for example, for synchrotron, we go to very low frequencies, like Haslam, the Haslam map, which is was done by the Jodrell-Bank Observatory, actually. And Haslam is a map at 408 megahertz. And the idea is really to look in the frequency range in which you know that a specific emission from the galaxy is going to dominate. So you don't have to worry about the other components. You can look at one specific component, but you have to go to a very specific frequency, in this case 408
megahertz. What's special about 408 megahertz?
408 megahertz is, let's say, is low enough that, again, free-free doesn't really kick in, let's say. So the synchrotron is very high because this case is a power law, and so at 408 megahertz it really dominates. And then also in terms of technology, it is, let's say, a relatively easy frequency to observe, because then we have also to come to terms with technology. We can observe at any given frequency because, like, filters are optimized in specific ranges, so that's the other part of the problem. So on one side, as say theoreticians, we would like to observe at some given frequencies, but on the other side, we have to compromise with what the technology can offer.
When will you be satisfied that you have modeled the foregrounds accurately enough that you can say to the people who are interested in the cosmic microwave background, here you go, this is the signal that we expect to be due to these foreground physical processes. The rest is the CMB. At what point do you say, we've done it, we've modeled it correctly?
This is a very big question, because I think there is such a long way to go with the foregrounds. The problem of the foregrounds is that nowadays, an experiment like Planck, for example, is capable of observing the CMB at a resolution of 5 arc minutes. We don't have templates, so models of the foregrounds at 5 arc minute resolution. So, for example, for the synchrotron that I was mentioning before, our best template, the Haslam template, is almost at 1 degree. So we can see the gap between 1 degree and 5 arc minutes. Mm-hmm. And in between, we don't know. We have basically to scale down with models because we don't have the data. So that's one of the problems. The other problem I was mentioning is the anomalous emission. We don't know even what it is. It was found, it was discovered a bit more than 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But then it took almost 10 years to convince people that it was really there, because people didn't believe it. So for anomalous emission, still we need to do everything. The other problem is the polarization, because all these experiments, all the future experiments of CMB, not only want to look at the temperature anisotropies, but they want to look at polarization of the CMB. That's really the holy grail of cosmology. Because looking at polarization, we can even more break the degeneracy between all the cosmological models. And that's the only way we can really do it. The problem is that we basically need the information in polarization for all the foregrounds. And at the moment, we basically don't have any kind of information. So we know that synchrotron is polarized. We know that free-free is basically not polarized. We know that dust is polarized. But we basically don't know how. We don't know. We don't have maps. And so it's going to take a very long time, I think, before we will manage to fill up all these gaps.
So you mentioned that in order to discriminate between competing cosmological models for the observed temperature anisotropies in the CMB, we now look toward polarization. The polarization itself, is just simply the angle of polarization looking in different directions in the sky?
Yes. Yeah. The concept that for CMB is basically exactly what applies to any other light, let's say, also visible light. So we basically think that there was an imprint in the photons of CMB at the surface of last scattering. So they basically got polarized on the surface, and this polarization keeps the track of basically of this surface of last scattering. So it can really tell us, for example, if we know that there is a signal which is due to gravitational waves. So, and this signal can be basically seen in polarization. And that's the way basically we can say, okay, we see a polarized signal in the CMB. So we know that there are basically perturbations in the primordial universe which are due to gravitational waves. And that's basically the only way to see it. Otherwise, we have no way to directly see it. The only way is through polarization of the CMB. And this is why polarization is going to open up a complete new perspective on the CMB and on the primordial universe itself.
It's remarkable to think that we've gone from just looking at the CMB, and in the first observations it looked completely flat. It looked just like a black body, and there was none of these little wiggles anywhere. In whatever direction you looked at, it looked completely flat, just like a black body. And then when COBE flew and they did their analysis and they could discover these little temperature fluctuations of what's the order of the temperature fluctuations?
10 to the minus 5.
Tiny Kelvin fluctuations.
Yes. Yeah.
And how much harder is it to detect the polarization signal than the temperature signal now?
Yeah. So polarization is the real challenge, because nowadays basically all the experiments for detecting temperature and isotropies, all the experiments are basically in quite a good shape. Polarization is a very different business in a way, because polarization is 10%, represents 10% of the fluctuations in temperature. So if we have a signal of 10 to the minus 5 Kelvin, in polarization it's going to be 10 to the minus 6. Mm. So it's going to be a very tiny little signal. And the problem is really the foregrounds. I go back to the foregrounds because for polarization, since we are basically so ignorant in the way the foregrounds are polarized, the challenge is really to distinguish a signal that is so tiny from something that is so dominant and so unknown. So are we going to be able to do this? That's a big challenge. In a way, nobody knows. We think we can, because again, an experiment as Planck has been designed to have a sufficient frequency coverage to disentangle all these components, even if we don't really know how they behave. But we can basically exploit all the knowledge we have in terms of frequency dependencies of the foregrounds and anyway all the physics that we know that these foregrounds follow to make this separation. But I think just the Planck data will answer this question, and so hopefully we will manage to detect the polarization.
Will Planck be the first instrument to measure the CMB polarization?
On a full sky level, yes, definitely. The WMAP did produce polarized maps. But again, the problem was that WMAP was not sufficiently, first of all, was less sensitive than Planck. So when an instrument is less sensitive, it means the noise dominates over a signal which is so tiny, like, for example, the polarization that you want to measure. So Planck is much more sensitive, so it should go down to a level of, let's say, of signal to noise, which WMAP couldn't achieve. That was one thing. Other experiments have observed the CMB. CBI is one of these experiments, which is the cosmic background imager. In Caltech, actually. There are other experiments like DAISY. It's an interferometer at the South Pole. Now there is a balloon which is going to be launched the next year, which is called Polar Bear. So there are lots of lots of experiments. The problem of all these experiments is usually that, again, they don't have a full sky coverage, so statistically they have a much less amount of data to study. The other problem is they don't reach, again, the frequency coverage of Planck. That's always a big problem when you want to disentangle the foregrounds. So again, I don't want to advertise here Planck, but Planck is going to be basically the first experiment which may really give not a definite answer, of course, but at least a robust detection.
So the data from these other experiments you mentioned are not sufficient to help you out with the problem of this anomalous signal, this anomalous polarization signal. So you can't even get a handle on where to start with the models to see whether any of them agree with the current data. So you're really hoping that the data that come from Planck will be in themselves enough to give you the CMB and also this anomalous signal, or the foregrounds anyway.
Yes, well, in fact, so because we have two problems. One is the polarization of the CMB that I mentioned, and the other one is the anomalous emission for the foregrounds. And in a way, Planck could be the experiment answering these two questions, because on one side, it will be the first experiment to produce a full sky map of the anomalous emission, which is the emission of the galaxy. It's one of the components of the galactic emission. And on the other side, it could be the first experiment giving a detection of the polarization on a full sky, and probably detected in the cleanest way so far. Mm-hmm. So could answer both these questions, which would be good.
Very exciting. We're looking forward to hearing the results.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your time. And thank you for talking to us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So interesting stuff there from Roberta, and we look forward, of course, to the results from Planck when it flies. So that's all for this issue of the Jodcast. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Again, if you've got any comments or feedback or questions, please go to www.jodcast.net and ask them. And so it just remains for me to say thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you next episode. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.